Go talk to them.
Please, that's totally on from the front door.
Okay,
Monsieur Attachon?
Yeah.
No,
well, probably off a little bit. And I do want to talk about the team in September. Graduate school stuff.
Because he only has actually one line. One line on each, so it doesn't matter. The next he wants, Let's go back to page 582. The next one, he doesn't actually have a, my Rav didn't say very much. We are up to the attribute, which is the last line, which was the Yishuv, and we spoke about that yesterday. We said the Yishuv means that a person should have the deliberate and carefully consider things which he before he said them or engages in them. And the Maharal just said, with the hand up to two lines. At the bottom of the bottom left-hand column, he says, Halacha Yud-Hashu Beis, the 12th aspect is the Yishuv, Perush, should the Yishuv Adas, he should have tranquility of spirit. Shim Ein Da'atun Lushevet Allah, if he doesn't have, not tranquility, calmness of spirit. Because if he's not calm, Ein Yachol Yomot, he can't learn. So what he's saying is that if a person constantly is distracted, so it's very difficult for him to study. I once had a Rebbe many years ago who said to us, this is when I was in high school, he said to us that if you think about the same issue and concentrate for 5 minutes straight, you have no idea how many problems you'd be able to solve. The problem is that very rarely are we able to concentrate intellectually, not daydream. We're able to daydream for long periods of time. But to think intellectual thoughts for 5 minutes straight is almost superhuman feat. I can tell you because many years later, and I still find it extremely rare that I can think about something for 5 minutes straight. I've written 3 books and many articles based on 30 seconds of spurts of thought. You know, that's the way it usually works. Most people have 30 seconds of thought or maybe 45 seconds and they immediately get distracted and start thinking about something else. So it's like, you know, a computer which multitasks. You know, we do many things simultaneously. So you can't think, then you come back, think, come back. And that's not so good, because that way, of course, nothing ever gets completely thought out, but you have just snips and snippets of thought at various different times. So that happens a lot, and therefore we fall short in what we're able to understand fully, because in order to achieve full understanding, the person really has to be engaged. Not just that he's calm in the external sense, that he's not distracted by our sorts of outside stimuli, but that inside his mind he's able to focus and concentrate himself. So again, it seems that once upon a time they were able to do that to a much greater extent. Today it's very, very difficult. I think it's part of the American, modern personality that prevents us from doing that. I saw many years ago, I don't remember when it was, sometime I think in the mid-80s, early 90s, in a Consumer Reports, there was an article in which they said that in the 1950s, the average American saw in the course of the day 1,200 pieces of advertising. You know, billboards, bumper stickers, newspaper ads, television commercials, radio commercials, things. Slogans on shirts, you know, all sorts of things, 1,200 a day. And that, when this article was written, it was in report, so again, it was about 10, 15 years ago, it was 3,000 a day. So if a person, the average American, is subject to 3,000 pieces of advertising a day, and of course advertising is meant to distract you from whatever you're doing, so then it's very difficult to think to begin with, right? And in the course of your waking day, you have lots and lots of distractions just from advertising, right? Forget about the other distractions. And somebody once told me that if you watch the television news for any length of time, then you will see that they change change cameras about once every 7 seconds or quicker, because the average American's attention span has been figured out to be 7 seconds. So therefore, if the camera angles remain the same for more than 7 seconds, the average American's attention would begin to wander. So therefore, they have to actually change camera angles to keep you engaged in what you're watching. So it's a difficult situation which we find ourselves. Everything conspires to get us not to think. And that's why, of course, we're not so smart, because we don't think that much. But that's what you said last night, right? Wasn't that one of your statistics?
Yeah.
Well,
it's one of the reasons why our sages was on such a different level, because they're... So I was trying to get an understanding of why these human beings in the past were like so much more amazing.
Yeah.
And it is one of the reasons why, because they have more of a focus on their mind.
I think people can train their mind, what do you say? So
it seems like, yeah, I heard that from how you were talking, I heard about it seems like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. that people can pay the money to concentrate more.
Also, like, the biggest deal for us is drink. They drink. We call it the convention. And as you know, like, sometimes you have long dreams, like real dreams. But really people say it's like 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Sometimes I know, like, I can wake up at like 4:40 and I like ready to next fall asleep and I like long dream and I wake up again like 4:45. That was 5 minutes. All great things, they come, like, you don't need to think, but they come unconsciously, like mind processes and by itself.
Yes.
The mind is working while you're asleep, and that's why, you know, some problems that you tried to deal with while you were awake, and you couldn't come up with an answer, all of a sudden, the mind comes, it's like a computer working on its own.
The prototype of the absent-minded professor is a very good example, because the reason why a professor is absent-minded is less.
Is that
Disney film, but besides that became a part of the American one. Yeah, filmmaker. So, the material he invented was, I think, called Flutter. So there's something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway. So that's a stereotype. In fact, my father-in-law is a math professor, and he really fits them all perfectly. Because he's able, and my wife also has this, to lose himself in thought. Now, it's not daydreaming. He can actually focus on a thought. In higher mathematics, I have no clue how higher mathematics works, but in higher mathematics, for a long period of time. And you can't actually, if you try and get his attention, you see that you actually disrupting his train of thought, like he's coming down from the upper realm, you're bringing him down to earth, right? So in fact, that capacity to concentrate is something which, you know, people do have, even today, you know, people who are, you know, like that, to that mold. And I'm sure that's really understood that the sages were able to train their minds, to focus their minds to such a great extent that they're able to accomplish far more than we were able to accomplish, right? That's basically what, how we understand the difference between previous generations and our generation. The more distractions that there are, the less capable of thought people become. By the way, one of the great conspiracies to prevent people from thinking is computers. I don't know how many of you use computers extensively, and they actually do not facilitate thought. They actually deprive a person of the capacity to think. So you're constantly doing little tasks which are not totally not relevant to the issue at hand.
Yes. The thing is to convince you that it's more efficient. Right. Efficiency is part of the technopoly of how the world is now. It's convince you that efficiency inherently has a thing, regardless of the efficiency of what you're doing. But the rabbi mentioned before some of R.A. Kaplan's books in his Jewish Meditation, when he mentioned, you know, the nature of some not altered states in the grander sense, but mildly altered states wherein one goes into these modes like this, and that it is historically, I mean, it's quite normal that the situation was where people were trained in accessing and utilizing these modes and extending them and really taking advantage of them, and that some of the things that we've learned itself are composed the way they are and set up literally on the text itself, not to be read, but to be remembered, to be memorized, to be committed to memory, and to make the connections between things, even down to the way the syntax and sentences are structured, are basically remembered, not even text to text, but concept to concept between them. And the way literally they're made is in your memory that they would be able to fit together that way. So it's not out of the question for some of these things we've done now, but we don't know what to do with the amount of time. It's 24 hours now and 24 hours then. We don't properly know how, in terms of putting these things together. And then the world literally works against us doing that. Yeah.
In Chassidus, it's understood, the Chassidus thought, that the way a person achieves prophecy is by ever, this is what I happen to write, is by ever greater degrees of focus and concentration internally.
Sure.
I mean, every Jew has, it's hardwired to accomplish prophecy. The question is just, can he tap into those depths of his soul and accomplish it? So obviously it takes, the way I happen and others put it, that takes a lot of years of training, and it takes a lot of focus. But the deeper a person delves into his own self, the more closer he comes to prophecy. Even if he doesn't actually become a prophet, but he comes closer to prophecy. In fact, if you have Fessner, the Quentin Thomas Shapiro, and the student's obligation is his book, the translation of his book in Hebrew, beautiful book, it's worthwhile reading, he says that Yeah, the really the whole purpose of a person's life is to try and delve as deeply as they can into that power of prophecy, and to try, even if you can't become a real prophet, but to hook up with that power which you have within you. And that's part of the reason why they believe, the Hasidim believe, that there is no need for external proofs. I think I still close to this with a couple of there's no reason, no need for external proofs or evidence of God's existence or the validity of Torah and all that kind of stuff, because it's inside your soul. If you just get in touch with what's inside of you, then that is the greatest proof or evidence, and you don't need to have any external proof or evidence. It's an interesting concept. In some way, it involves deeper thought. In other ways, it's kind of anti-intellectual. It does involve deeper thought in one way, internally, and it rejects kind of deeper thought externally based on going and studying different things. So it's an interesting paradox.
You know, you have to make a differentiation between mathematical thinking, which is logical, pure logic, and philosophical thinking, where you establish connections of intellectual creation. When you establish those connections, there is an emotional component involved. Even though we try to abstract it and make it intellectual, it's still emotional. That's why they have to feel that way.
That's a good point, right. So yeah, it's not pure, right, that's a very good point. It's an emotional component in their thought.
Intuitive.
Yeah.
It's only emotional.
Well, it's not intuitive, it's not exactly.
If you have a,
it's closer to intellectual.
Case of realization that anything that comes to you from outside your body is not true. It's a perception of truth. Nothing that is outside your body is true.
The fascinating thing. You, Rabbi Gessler writes exactly the same thing. I don't remember where he writes it, but he writes it somewhere in the old structure truth in English. He says that most people live by the perceptions which come to them by their senses. And those perceptions come by their senses are inherently not false, but misleading. A person has to actually live by those things which are within, that is, the perception which he has internally, and work from his inside out, not from his outside in, which is really what you're saying.
Then you have the tricky part of actually differentiating what you think is within you.
Right, it is very difficult.
Such a very...
Okay, I'm sure. Right. So they have... You're absolutely right. That's what a person has to do. In fact, all this a person can really only do if a person has the capacity, and most people do not, and I include myself in most people, most of the have the capacity to actually think for long, or at least 5 minutes, periods of time undisturbed, and calmly. It's a very difficult thing to do.
So, can I ask you, I don't know if this is an appropriate question, certain kind of drugs, isn't you allowed to smoke marijuana?
It's a good question. I will answer it.
You will?
I will answer it. And the Gemara says in, so who's recording this? just don't distribute it. The Gemara says in, in the Sefer Sukkah, Gemara says that Hamra very honey tasting. It says, it's a very difficult Gemara at first class, it says that wine and fragrances make a person smarter. So the question is, what are wine and how do wine and fragrances make a person smarter? If anything, I would think that wine distracts a person from thought, and what fragrances have to do with it. So it would seem that what the Gemara is saying, first of all, with wine, you see that still in Chabad Chassidim. Obviously, alcoholic beverages are a large part of their, their divine service, and it's because it puts them into a higher state of consciousness. And also, it seems that there are certain smells or fragrances which also put a person into a mode in which their mind works better. Now, I have, Now, I have never had marijuana, so I can't tell you how it works. But so you want to tell us?
I had a roommate at university who was doing his PhD in sports science and use of marijuana in performance. And it's quite intriguing. There are two drugs that I can't see that are a problem. One is marijuana, the other one is magic mushrooms. What are you talking about? I had an experience on magic mushrooms.
Which are they actually mushrooms?
They are mushrooms, yes. Which was the deepest, most incredible experience I've ever had in my life. I actually discovered something after Perky Adams without even heard of Perky Adams.
Uh-huh.
Almost word for word.
Uh-huh.
And I never read it. I never knew it.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things magic mushrooms does is it focuses your mind. You can do it without magic mushrooms, it might take 30 years. Martial artists do it.
Does it do to your mind?
Your mind.
It focuses, it doesn't distract you.
The first few times you take it, it's like a new toy, you don't know what to do with it, it's just fun. And you play with it. But after you've only taken it 10 times, don't take it a long time. And the 10th time I had it, it was like no longer a toy.
Wow.
And it was almost like, wow, I'm actually thinking straight, and nothing's distracting me.
So why did you stop there?
Why did I stop taking it?
Yeah.
It's really easy to take in Thailand where you're on a really nice island. It's different if you take it in a country where it's like dangerous to walk out your front door because you're not in touch with the danger, the reality. You might get run over or you might start to jump to the building.
Uh-huh.
But in Thailand, like, you take your parameters, like don't go in the water. Mm-hmm.
Well, you're in touch, you lose control, in other words. When you're under the influence of the drug.
You don't lose control. Completely the opposite. All your senses work more. I mean, the other thing that Einstein said that we use like 5-10% of our brain.
Right.
But all of a sudden you're using all your brain.
Uh-huh. And it takes a set of strands and you can recover it. And you don't have any, you don't have boundaries, so it's not dangerous. You can touch something with your
heart. No,
that's right. You do have boundaries. And it's external. You need to look whole.
But you have it, look, it's your mind. It's your mind. It's not like
something you have a lot of different things with the same. If something is hot, I don't need to think. It comes to a boiling, the thing is boiled, right? I won't touch it because I'm conscious I'm not dangerous. I don't need to think about it. But you, like in such a state of strength, adventures, I don't need to think. But you need to put some emotional effort. Like you drive and you do it unconsciously. Like you space out in order to.
You mean
that right. You can drive it, I'll drive. Right.
That often happens. You drive along, you think, actually,
where's
the
other
game?
Right.
You need to put up very different things. You move some external blocks. You might get external. Like Judaism, instead of having internal blocks like complex, like you can't talk to ladies, you can't do this. A lot of people without Judaism, they're very not uncomfortable talking to girls, they're very not comfortable to do all the things. It's like an internal state. Judaism makes this boundary external. I don't have problems to talk to girls, but I'm not like a bit awful, right? Like, I don't have problems with straight or food. But I use my brain instead of like using my emotions. Is that right?
So are you asking when you're on drugs if they will go?
You use it internal. You have the need to think about it. You need to
maybe explain more. It's more kind of like, we don't make mushrooms, when you pick up this cup.
I just took out the blood in fact.
Your awareness of things is incredible. Like, you pick up the cup. You don't pick up the cup. Like, normally you just pick up the cup. Because your senses are working at such an overdrive, you're like, wow, okay, there's the cup. And you feel it. And all your senses, everything you feel. Then there's certain things kind of like, it's really bizarre how your mind works. I need to just go back to my heart. And I'm standing on the beach and I think, okay, now it's that way. And I'm walking along, and I stop, I'm lost. And there's just trees around me. And there's no point of reference whatsoever. And I'm standing thinking, oh, where's my heart? And the trees are all the same. And all of a sudden my hands just lift up. And all my hands are a whole line of skulls. Green skulls with red eyes. And I'm looking thinking, where they come from? They're not dangerous or anything, they're just like there. And they start looking in a direction and I just follow them. And then I stop, and then they disappear, and I put my hands down, and they come up. And it's kind of like, okay, I've got no idea how I found my house. But what it is my brain basically. My brain is working on senses that I'm not used to. And that sense is like, you could close your eyes and you could walk through a forest. And your brain has recognized the sounds, everything around you. So you're accessing parts of your brain you never even realized you had. How did I find my forest back to the hut? There's like trees, there's just trees everywhere. If you were to put me back there, in a total sober state, I could never have found my hut. And it's incredible what it does to the senses.
I did think that it's complete opposite of being drunk, though.
It's not necessarily having an hallucinatory experience.
Obviously.
That's what you had while you were under the influence of drugs. But I'll tell you another story. It's about 45 years ago in South America. You were using LSD in order to expedite the psychic processes You know, the idea was so you only need to be for 15 or 20 years in analysis in order to work out the capital problems and never using LSD.
In a therapeutic context.
Yes. But it never worked.
Well, that seems a bit scary because LSD is not natural. And I would never take something.
Well, all of these things boil down to chemical compounds, and different chemical compounds DDT, it's a chemical, it's a pesticide, it's a set of chemical compounds that were made to design, like LSD, is a design thing to do certain kinds of things. So the consequence being it also made interruptions in the egg cells for eagles, and eagle eggs did not last very long. Those compounds are also naturally occurring compounds in different contexts, like DMT, we won't get into it. But these things will down to chemical compounds. One set of chemical compounds makes you drunk, stupid, and results in alcoholic poisoning. Other compounds result in these reactions in the brain. This drug causes something that can be called a trance, wherein your body does not respond to this, wherein you are blocked out from the rest of the world. I mean, all these lots of different things cause lots of different things. Lots of different food has lots of different situations in different spots. And it's not something that is a uniform discussion. This is a trance, so that's the same thing that is what you experience, which is this, where the same sets of hallucinations are had that are neurological ones, that are things that your eyes are, your retinas are not responding to an external stimuli, whereas other ones amplify.
And your brain is.
Your retina is not, but your brain is not in your brain.
How do you feel emotionally when you're on this?
Oh, you have a very strong emotional reaction.
It's tremendous. Very dull.
That's part of the therapy.
Before I ever saw on the drug, I tried to find out as much as possible. I didn't want to go into it. It's scary well without knowing about it. It saturates the way people bring down the moral. You should never, ever touch a drug if you're depressed. Because if I was happy, so I was happy. If you're depressed, there was actually one moment when I actually had fear. One moment where I started getting paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's very dangerous.
It's very dangerous. And it was actually the night that I had the deepest understanding. And I walked away from the people I was with. And I walked away and I stood on my own. And I confronted it. And I realized that the only thing is it's you. You've got nothing to be scared of. People don't realize at the time that they're depressed because it's something that never makes
you. Oh, yes, you have something to be scared of.
Not as far as control of your mind.
You know why LSD became illegal? Well, because people killed other people under the influence of LSD. So you should be scared.
If a person's an angry person, that's
a
problem.
No! Because of their experience, they became paranoid. And they live in that paranoid delusion. Well, I've only taken
LSD once.
And I've never tested it. And the mushrooms and LSD are two completely different things. One is made by Hashem and one is made by man. I don't trust drugs that are made by man.
That's because one is a set of chemical compounds wherein this is a pattern, and another one is a set of chemical compounds where this is a pattern. That's not denying what you're saying at all.
Any scientist who's worked their sorts in anything realizes that they are nothing compared to the reality of what is really going on. No scientist knows anything about the totality of what they're doing. So there's a difference, but a magic mushroom, Hashem knows the totality of it. But the scientists just think they know the totality of it. Then there's a whole world out there that they've got no idea about.
Okay, let's go back to marijuana. What does marijuana accomplish?
Marijuana...
So I have to tell you, there's an opinion, wherever I happen to visit down, living there, that part of the incense in the base of Mikdash was cannabis, was marijuana.
This is the stuff I want to know. Marijuana is more stimulant, but it calms you down, and it slows you down. And I know this one guy, the only two drugs he takes, and like when he's taking drugs, he won't watch television. He's like a nomad. He doesn't eat any foods unless it's off treats and cooked. He doesn't eat chocolate, because that's a drug. He won't eat anything unless it's completely cured. He takes two drugs, one of mushrooms, and one of marijuana. Well, he tells me he comes from a nomadic tribe, from ancient Poland. And he's a very, very holy man. He's quite an incredible guy.
So how do you meet this guy? You don't have to answer.
I'm very honest,
pal. One time we were looking for magic mushrooms in the field. And he was standing behind us with a staff with a feather coming out of a room camouflage plate with a big long beard and massive mushrooms.
That was a whole story of an African.
Yeah, it was favorite testing. They love it. Whatever. This is the wrong season to be picking it.
No, no, it's really funny. I just wanted to touch it to make sure I wasn't imagining it.
Yeah,
that's incredible. This guy was incredible. He's mine. He came to our house and he read some poetry. Never heard anything like it before in my life. This guy stood for 5 minutes to recite some poetry on some paper. He'd written, word perfect. And he was like, how does he do that? He does it because he takes mushrooms and it focuses his mind. And he takes marijuana because he has to take marijuana. Because if you ever met anyone who lived on magic mushrooms, you won't understand a word that they're saying.
Hardly enough.
We'll go so quickly, they'll go through everything like it so quickly. It's like what you're saying, if you thought for 5 minutes, so straight. It would be incredible, but nobody else would be able to figure out what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And he has to take marijuana to slow himself down, to bring him to a speed that he can actually relate to others.
And you listened to him while you were under the influence?
Sorry? He does poetry nights and people listen to him and it's like... Pretty much like...
Okay, so all this goes into issues here. it's a calm mind. And a focused mind. Obviously there are, so getting back to that Gemara and Sukkah, obviously the Gemara felt that there were certain things, substances, I don't know how what they were and how they used them, it doesn't say anything about mushrooms, but they were obviously used in order to focus and the mind, in order to get a person's mind to function in a higher, better way. I think, you know, in part of the attraction to Yeshiva Bachram in smoking, when smoking was okay, was the fact that it helped them to focus their mind. And, you know, I used to smoke a pipe. It used to be a
what about
Until I got engaged to my wife. You're right. It's not necessarily the thing itself.
You have that feeling when they drive themselves into state of ecstasy. How different is the state of ecstasy that the acid will be in? To a state of ecstasy induced by a drug.
No, well, it certainly doesn't promote intellectual thought. The question is what here, we're talking about not driving yourself to a state of ecstasy where one is experiencing very close, very high degree of emotional closeness to God. We're talking about in this Mishnah, what's going to get you to be able to function intellectually on a higher level. The Hasidim, when they're trying to achieve ecstasy, they're not trying to achieve intellect. If anything, intellect is negative. It's not what this mission is about. This mission is about how to acquire Torah, intellectual acquisition. So that one fit into this. Okay, so that's that one. That's Yishuv. And then it's interesting, the Mishnah here brings down a couple of things which you would have expected to come earlier. It's interesting that they come here. And the Maharal doesn't even explain them because they're so obvious, which are Mikra and Mishnah, which are learning Tanakh and learning Mishnais. It seems that all the things we learned till now, you have to have before you start being able to fully understand what's going on. So as you know, you look at all the things we did now, all the took were traits. They're all aspects of a learning personality. And now it says, once you have that learning personality down pat, then you can start learning Mikra and Mishnah. Now, I don't know, you know, that's why it's difficult to apply this. You know, when I read this Mishnah, I always think of Rabbi Akiva. Now, like somebody who's 40 years old and starting for the first time to learn. Because it's hard to see by a little kid that a little kid is going to acquire all these traits which we described before. You know, a tranquil mind, awe, ear, intelligence, understanding. It seems you first start teaching him the stuff and then hopefully it develops over time. So I think that here when Mishnah's talking about these are the way, because this is the way you acquire, they're already talking to somebody who has, you know, a fully developed intellect, emotion, or telling him you want to approach Torah at your level, this is the way you approach Torah, because otherwise we would have started the Mishnah with Mikra and Mishnah at the beginning. You learn first Tanakh, the Bible, and then you learn the Mishnah afterwards. So I assume that that's why it's over here, again, because one has to work on these things before. This is the Bali Musar, the people who are in the Musar movement, always had, before they began learning Gemara in the morning, they always have a short Musar Seder, time to involve themselves in working on their character traits, right, and their personalities, which had nothing to do with what they were about to learn, the Gemara that they were about to learn, which could have been a highly technical piece of, halacha. And the reason why they did that is because it's axiomatic that Torah can only be approached out of a personality, can only be approached fully, when the personality is developing itself in a more refined manner. So therefore, similar to that, this Mishnah, which all the many types of refinement preceded the level where one began to actually come into learning. One has to come into learning with a certain sense of refinement. And this is interesting because it connects up to a statement made by Reb Chaim Vital. Reb Chaim Vital was one of the great students of the Ari, the 15th, 16th century Kabbalist in Sfat. And he asked a question, it's a very important question to ask, which is, the Torah never says explicitly that you should have a good pair of character traits, what's called in Hebrew midos. Never says you're supposed to have good midos. Never says you shouldn't get angry. It never says you shouldn't be the miser. It never says you should be patient, you should be tolerant. It never says you should be nice. Why didn't it say all these things? The Torah has lots and lots of mitzvahs, but it never specifically, or very rarely, and almost never, speaks about character traits, personality, and all that kind of stuff. The Talmud is full of it, right? Tells us that, and especially Pirkei Avos, has many, many things about your personality and character, but not the Torah itself. So Chaim Vital says, along the lines which we were just saying, that the Torah is a second stage. We say earlier in Pirkei Avos, Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah. Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah means human perfection, or and at least a striving for human perfection, precedes Torah. And therefore, the Torah itself, the five books of Moses, can only be approached after a person has fixed his character traits. So therefore, the Torah doesn't dwell on it. It says, you know what? This is stage two already. We're assuming something has taken place before you come to learn Torah. In a way, although he doesn't say this in Chaim Vital, but you can understand that based on this, another chazal, another statement of the rabbis, which says that Yafesi Chasin Shal Afri Avos, the discussions of the slaves of the forefathers, that's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is considered to be more precious than the Torah of the children, meaning the children of Israel. And the Gemara considers that, but the Gemara says that when Eliezer came to find a wife for Yitzchak, for Isaac, and he came to the house of Bethuel and Lavan, and eventually he took Rivka back to be the wife. So it tells the story twice. First it tells the story as it happened, and then the story relates how Eliezer, the servant, recounted the entire story to the members of the household. Now, I came today to the well, my master sent me, he gave me all this stuff, I came to the well, and so on and so forth. So tremendous amount of verses, which are dedicated to the story, redundant verses. At the same time, the Gemara says, you have so many issues in the Torah which are just alluded to. Like Tzuma and Tara, the Tzuma, the impurity of certain types of, dead beings, dead creatures, or Shabbos itself. Most of the laws of Shabbos are extrapolated from the Mishkan, from how they built the tabernacle, are not explicit in the Torah at all. They're not mentioned. It's just alluded to in a very, very brief and terse allusion. So the understanding of that is that the reason why we have Bereishis, the book of Genesis, which has very few mitzvos and very, very little halacha in it, preceding the other four parts of the Torah, which had most of the Jewish law, is because one has to learn how to conduct oneself, how to behave, and the Torah spends more time discussing that, relatively speaking, than spends talking about the actual halacha, because that is a precondition. So therefore, one has to work on one's personality as a precondition to accomplishing greatness in Torah. If one doesn't work on one's personality, then the Torah is not full Torah. So it can't be completely grasped and understood, because by definition, Torah is a refining quality. If you have a refining quality to it, if you don't approach Torah with the attitude, I want to be refined, and I'm working on it, then that nuance of Torah will be lost to you. This is interesting because the Ramban in Parshas Nachmanides, in Parshas Ki Tetzer, he brings down another statement of the rabbis, which is very, very important, which is that it says in this medrash, says, do you think God cares how you slaughter an animal? Whether you slaughter it from the front of the neck, we slaughter from the front of the neck, whether you slaughter from the back of the neck. Why did God tell us, you should slaughter an animal, make sure you slaughter it from the front, or not from the back?
So for God, what does it make? What does he care? Why does he have to tell us this? So the Rebbe says, the reason is because if you slaughter from the front of the neck, it's a more humane type of slaughter. The animal suffers less. No, that's me. That's what it says. And there, and the mitzvahs were given to refine people. The mitzvahs were given to us in order to refine us, in order to make us more refined, more elevated, more transcendent people. So therefore, it works both ways. In other words, you're supposed to approach the Torah with an attitude that you're already working on refining your personality, and then Torah tempts you, enables you to refine your personality to a greater extent. So it's a cyclical thing. But you have to first begin with refinement and end with refinement. And if you find somebody who doesn't have that refinement, then, you know, there's going to be something wrong with their Torah as well. It's not fully penetrating their being. They're not fully receptive of what its values are, and that's a problem. Okay? So that's why Mikra and Mishnah, I think, why Mikra and Mishnah, the actual material took parts of the Torah, come later than the things before. Now, the next thing, Miut Schora, you've got to take a look at the next few, and you're on the last one, page 582, they all have similar language. In the Yarnskov uses the word limited, in the English, in the Hebrew uses mute, right? Then Miut Schora, limited business activity, Miut Erecheret, limited sexual activity, as we translate here, Miut Shena, limited sleep, limited pleasure, limited sleep, limited conversation, limited laughter. So the simple understanding of the Mishnah, which is one legitimate understanding, is that what the Torah is telling, the Mishnah is telling you, listen, you want to be an intellectual as opposed to just a regular person, you got to limit these activities. You have to make sure to transcend these activities which are material, and to a certain extent even mistake, and try and focus yourself on more intellectual, more, you know, abstract things. So you have to diminish your involvement in all these things. That's a simple understanding. But I just happened last week, there's a very, very powerful idea I'm about to tell you. And I only saw it myself for the first time by sheer accident a week ago. And I've been waiting to try to tell it over. The Vilna Gaon says, and this is totally out of character for what you think about the Vilna Gaon, what he's right for the Vilna Gaon. He speaks specifically about the Miut Sicha one, which means limited conversation, but it would apply to all the rest of them as well. He says, Miut Sicha does mean you should diminish the amount of conversation. It means a person who learns Torah day and night and doesn't take any time out to have normal conversation with somebody, so his personality will be distorted. He won't come out being a normal person. There'll be something wrong with him. At some point, either he'll snap, he'll have like a breakdown, or he'll become a weirdo. So therefore,
he'll be a hermit.
Whatever, yeah. So therefore, the Mishnah is telling us, according to that understanding of the Gemara, you know, Miut Sicha, it's important for the scholar to take a little bit of time out to what we say, to call what we do, to do schmoozing. What? The same idea. So if you understand it that way, like the Gemara, and you understand the rest of them that way, it's a very, very different lesson altogether. What it means is that a person should not attempt to be involved in intellectual pursuits 24/7, 365. It can't work that way. It's impossible for a human being. For an angel, it would be possible. But you're not an angel. You are a human being. So as a human being, there are certain things which a person has to be involved with in order to maintain that humanity, which is part and parcel of the human condition. So if you look at it that way, the Mishnah reads very, very beautifully. The Mishnah says that you have to have a little bit of commerce, right? A little bit of commercial activity. That's what Kola is. So it means he doesn't have to actually go out and make money, you know, per se. He doesn't have to go out and sell. What? He has to understand the world of commerce. In other words, the person has to, even if I'm a chacham, a person wants to be a great scholar, much scholarship depends on understanding how the commercial world works. It has to do a lot with, because the entire section of Shulchan Aruch, called Cheshen Mishpat, is all about the laws of commercial activity and financial markets and all those things which occur when a person is involved in transacting business. So therefore, a person can't understand fully what The Torah is about and lets the person understand what the realm of commercial activity is about, to at least some limited extent. He doesn't have to go out and get a degree in economics, but he has to have a little bit of an understanding. Like it says here, limited sexual activity. The Gemara says that the rabbis made certain restrictions, which were meant in order that Tamidei Chachamim, in order that scholars, this is the way the Gemara puts it, should not frequent their wives like roosters. I guess roosters are very promiscuous. I don't know what how exactly a chicken coop works, but I guess if you leave a rooster alone with a lot of hens, then he gets very busy. So the Gemara says that a Talmid Chacham should not have that kind of, that kind of promiscuity, even with his own wife. They made limitations, but they didn't say abstain altogether. That's an idea which is foreign to Judaism. There's one exception to which it establishes Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was told he was angelic. He was almost on the level of an angel. He had this unique relationship with God, so he was told, you know what, for you it's not necessary. You should stay away from it. But for everybody else who's not on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, on the contrary, if you you see this from the Catholic priests, right, I don't have to tell you, this is all current events, right, you see that if the people are told to abstain, then all sorts of negative byproducts occur. So therefore, so it says, he says, a little bit of derech eretz, whatever the rabbi takes, something which is moderate, so that's necessary for a person to have. It's interesting, the Mishnah says somewhere that a Talmid Chacham is supposed to have a relations with his wife once a week, so the Gemara says. So Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked, I don't know if the question actually has written in the Gross Moshe in his response. I don't think that it actually says who asked the question, because it would probably become somewhat embarrassing. But he said, my wife wants to have relations more often. Is that permissible? Right? So I guess he was a scholar, and he was asking whether it's permissible to do it more than once a week. So he said, Rav Moshe Feinstein, in our day and age, when the world is more licentious, so therefore, it penetrates our society, and one has to make concessions to that. So he said, yes, okay. So the idea is, again, it's not necessarily a precise formula, but rather it's meant to be a measure not to be too much involved and not completely to separate oneself.
One question: derech eretz doesn't mean respect more than
respect. But here it's a euphemism, obviously. Very, or sometimes derech eretz in the Torah means. In shas means proper behavior towards another person. Sometimes it means work, actual labor or being involved in society. And sometimes it means it's a euphemism for sexual relations. So depending on the context, it can have different meanings.
The other issue talking about the rooster. Roosters are known for being extremely aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they are aggressive sexually. Like the bull.
Okay.
But what they're saying here is contain your aggression.
Right. That's the idea. That's a mute derech eretz. Then the next one is mute tahor. So that's the same idea. If you understand it simply, it means that a person has diminished the amount of pleasure which a person has. But on the flip side is that a little bit of pleasure is okay. It depends how you use the pleasure and how far you go. And that's probably very difficult to know precisely the boundary. There's a very well-known Gemara. The Gemara says that there was a certain Talmid Chacham who said that it's not possible for him to learn well unless he has fatty meat, and it was amazing that fatty meat was considered to be good, right? So that unless he has fatty meat and old wine, good wine. So there's certain people have greater need for pleasures, some people have less of a need for pleasures. The Mishnah said before that, crappy backers, let's take a look at this later Mishnah. The Mishnah about the Mishnah 4 on the same page, 582, 582, 582, a little bit further up. So it says, this is the way of Torah. Eat bread with salt, drink water in small measure, sleep on the ground, live a life of deprivation, but toil is Torah. If you do this, you are praiseworthy and all is well with you. You are praiseworthy in this world and all is well with you in the world to come. So this is the way the article goes. It says, asceticism is not being advocated here. One who is wealthy is not expected to cast away his wealth in the pursuit of Torah. Rather, this is a general call for moderation and an address to the poor person. Even if you are poverty-stricken, do not neglect Torah study to pursue tangible wealth. The serenity of character can be experienced even in privation, and one must always be prepared to sacrifice his personal comfort on behalf of the servant, which are actually two separate statements. A, if you're poor, you should learn to anyway, and B, a person should be prepared to surrender comforts of life in order to study Torah. But it doesn't mean that you have to. If you have no choice but to surrender them, so then you don't surrender them. But there's not a reason, you know, to go pitch a tent outside and sleep in the wet instead of sleeping inside a nice warm room. You don't have to sleep on the floor if you have a bed. If you don't have a bed, then you should be prepared to sleep on the floor. But otherwise, you're not required to go and do it. So that's the idea of need, kind of every person is created with a need for a certain amount of pleasure. And that's why the mitzvah on Shabbos, which we have, is Oneg Shabbos.
Right.
Oneg Shabbos means pleasure of Shabbos. And Rebbe writes in a few, something I've quoted many times, he says that a person does not fulfill the mitzvah of Shabbos if a person doesn't enjoy Shabbos. A person has to enjoy Shabbos, otherwise there's something lacking in Shabbos. The Mishnah Berurah, the Chof Chaim in his introduction to Hilchos Shabbos, the Mishnah Berurah said, you must learn the halachos of Shabbos. Why? Because it's not possible to keep Shabbos unless you know the halachos, and they're many and complex. And maybe you'll say, you know what? I don't have to learn halachos. I'll just sit on my stool all day, and I'll sit down in a chair, and I won't do anything. And that way I'll be safe. The Mishnah Berurah says, no, then you lose also, because then you didn't fulfill other Shabbos. And you don't fulfill Shabbos unless you enjoy the Shabbos. So therefore, just sitting and refraining is not enough. You actually have to actively go out and enjoy Shabbos, and that's why the mitzvah of Shabbos, of course. And Yom Tov, which comes more frequently, but the Yom Shabbos more to have pleasure, enjoy the words, to eat, to drink, and all that kind of stuff, in order that a person specifically should have that meal, kind of, that little bit of pleasure, which is necessary in order to keep a person going.
Especially sex. No, really.
Especially.
Well, several levels of thought.
You want to say, yeah. So well, that's one part of it, but, you know, that's for people, not all people get it all the time, because they're married because of half a month for many Jewish males, their wife is a nigga, so then they're stuck. So the idea is that you find Shabbos, you find pleasure in Shabbos in alternative ways. Ideally speaking, it should be a measure, a mixture of various different pleasures, but they're supposed to be done, and the Torah does dictate that, at least on a regular interval once a week. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Maybe not today. Sex and drugs are the same thing.
Not
I don't know if it would actually be possible to have that class on market. The next one, of course, Miu Chena, says about the grog, the Vilna Gong. I had a friend who was able to do this, actually, that he would sleep 2 hours out of every 24. And he would be learning most of all the entire rest of the time. Actually, when I was in high school, I needed 7 hours of sleep a day. And I was able, through the years of being in yeshiva, to work that down to the time, to work that down to 4 hours a day. Now it doesn't, which is now my minimum is 4 hours a day. Doesn't mean I won't be grumpy the rest of the day. I will be able to function the rest of the day. So again, according to the graph, it could work both ways. So I can tell you, well, you're supposed to diminish the amount of sleep you get, right? To work it down, because you shouldn't have to sleep that much, right? Which is interesting because the Rambam and other sources don't advocate diminishing the amount of sleep. The Rambam says he contradicts himself. In one place he says you need 6 hours of sleep. In another place he says you need 8 hours of sleep. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, who was a great sage of the 20th century, lived here in Mutzi, used to tell people that they should sleep always 8 hours a night. So I haven't tried that in many years, except on Shabbos, really. But I don't know, maybe the mind does work better if you do it, get more sleep.
How many hours did my mother sleep
at night? Almost nothing.
No?
No, it's not other people what to do. Yeah.
That's what I
do. Yeah, he was busy all the time. Yeah, we really had almost no time to do anything other than to advise people. People were
right.
Doing all sorts of things.
Yeah, but this is practicing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not insane in one place. Yeah.
I just have a question. Before we had a lecture.
Oh, you missed a great class today.
Okay,
time to tell me the
people, once it gets dark, will people study around fire, candles, because all electric light, people use to sleep, to nature.
Yeah, there's a story about a